Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to another installment of New Books in Military History. This is your host, Jay Lockenauer from Temple University. The book we're considering today is The Soviet-Israeli War, 1967 to 1973, the USSR's Military Intervention in the Egyptian-Israeli Conflict, by Isabella Gunor and Gideon Remez, who are associate fellows at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. I chose this book in part because it's likely to arouse some controversy. It's an important book because it addresses so many related interests surrounding the Arab-Israeli conflict of the late 60s and early 1970s. It should be of interest not only to military historians and Israeli historians, Egyptian historians, but also historians of the Cold War, because part of the story that they uncover is the active involvement of both the Soviet Union and Russia and the United States in telling a certain story about the Egyptian-Israeli conflict that isn't entirely truthful and that serves the purposes of actors such as Henry Kissinger and even now today Vladimir Putin to mask the actual Soviet involvement in this conflict that Gunor and Remez uncover. The author's extensive, even laborious work in the available source material is really quite impressive. They work especially with memoirs and testimony of Soviet soldiers and officers who were actually stationed in Egypt to show that regular units of the Soviet army were engaged with Israeli forces, especially in the air battles over the Sinai Desert. I was encouraged to review the book in part because their first book, published in 2008, called Foxbats Over Dimona, won the silver medal from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy when they offered their inaugural book prize that year. I think you'll be just as impressed as I was after you listen to the interview. So, Isabella and Gideon, thanks for joining me. So I like to start the interviews by asking you to provide a kind of short intellectual biography. How did you come to this topic? What are your interests and that brought you to this particular topic?
Well, we have to start very early. Both of us were journalists, and both of us met covering the disintegration of the Soviet Union. I was working for Haaretz newspaper. Gilman was the head of the foreign news desk in Israeli national radio. And it was, according to the old Chinese wish, let you live in an interesting time. So it was a very interesting time, and we started to read material that we never expected to even to think about. It was fantastic. It was something that nobody paid enough attention before.
Our relationship actually started out as a professional one after we met at a Sovietologist conference on January 3rd, 1989, a very dramatic period.
Mm-hmm.
We began a co-production interviewing people throughout the Soviet Union by telephone, which was then already possible but still quite difficult. And we scored some international exclusives, and actually we became a source for quite a few other news outlets worldwide, not only here in Israel. And this became a project that went on for, 10, 15 years, which also wound up as a personal relationship between us, and that we already have two adult children. But the special or unique part of it was that because of the mass immigration that was then arriving in Israel from the Soviet Union and later from the former Soviet Union, there was an enormous readership here for news in Russian and news from the Soviet Union. And there was before the internet got off to a real start, there was a massive Russian language press here in Israel, which copied a lot of material out of various news outlets in the former Soviet Union, including some very obscure local ones. And Isabella used to come home every weekend with a pile of paper. We also had first the Israeli consulate and then the embassy, when the relations were restored, send us piles of paper that they were about to recycle in Moscow. Instead of recycling it, they sent it by the diplomatic pouch to us, so that we had a large reservoir of sources to go over, and we began seeing things that looked unbelievable at the time, as Isabella mentioned, because this was the period when, we're talking already, it was later than 89, of course, we're talking about the mid-90s, when the body of sources that has become one of our main source materials for this book and the previous one began to appear en masse. And this was memoirs and other publications of the Soviet veterans who actually took part in the intervention in the Middle East, which has become our specialty. And this began to appear and to be copied also in this Russian language press here. And the stories that we read there really were enormously intriguing because they contradicted everything that you might read in conventional Western and Israeli historiography up to that point.
So I think that's one of the interesting things about this book. I mean, the title alone tells us that you're revising this history. It's no longer the Six-Day War, a kind of lull, and then the Yom Kippur War. It's the Soviet-Israeli War, 1967 to 1973.
Yes, indeed. If we want to really summarize the book, we're saying that in this period, Israel was actually engaged in a direct head-on clash with a global superpower, the Soviet Union, at varying degrees of intensity. But at the peak in 1969-1970, there was an entire Soviet division deployed in Egypt, an air defense division, that is, anti-aircraft missiles and fighter squadrons, which were directly engaged with the Israelis and, in fact, tipped the balance in the Israeli-Egyptian confrontation at that time, the War of Attrition, as it was known, in the Egyptians' favor, thus really setting, creating the conditions for the Egyptian attack on Yom Kippur of 1973. So this is really the main message. We're talking here about a full-scale war, certainly in Middle Eastern terms, but I think also in global terms, between Israel and the global superpower, which is the first and only time that this has ever happened.
So tell us a little bit about why we haven't known this story before. In whose interest was it to keep this under wraps, and what other stories have been told to kind of take the place of this truth?
Well, let me start from the really surprised when one day I brought the newspapers home and started to read, and all of a sudden I see an interview with a former Soviet naval officer who tells to Ukrainian journalist that he was on the board of the ship and had to raise a group of volunteers, so-called volunteers, in quotes, 30 group, and prepare them for landing in Haifa port
on June 5th, 1967.
And I just couldn't believe my eyes, because in 1967 I was already living in Israel, and I remember that time very well, because we had to dig trenches for civilians to take cover in case of our place will be bombed and so on. So I asked, say to Given, do you know anything about landing in Haifa? No, they started to go.
And let me just interject that I fought in the Six-Day War. I was in the Israeli paratroops, so that I had known the war only on the ground level as a private. But I, since then, had been involved in journalism. The 73 war I already covered as a frontline correspondent, and I had never heard or read of anything like a Soviet plan or Soviet intention to invade Israel or to otherwise intervene against Israel in the Six-Day War. On the contrary, all the previous literature held that the Soviet Union didn't desire the war, that nobody had desired the war, and the Soviet Union did actually ignite the crisis by spreading disinformation about so-called Israeli troop concentrations. But once that got out of hand, they tried, together with the United States, to restrain their Middle Eastern allies. And when the war did break out, they did their best, together with the Americans, to stop it. Though, actually, if you go over the documentation that already existed from that period, that wasn't exactly the case. But there was never any inkling published that the Soviets prepared quite a massive intervention after drawing Israel, provoking Israel into a first strike, so that it could be justified as intervening on behalf of the victims of aggression.
So if I understand correctly, that's really the subject of your first book. Is that true?
Yes. I would also add that we investigated the person who published this interview, and we made a contact with him. And we started to understand that the secrecy was one of the main main ways for the Soviet Union to keep everything covered. For example, they would decide in Politburo about some steps. Not, at the moment, it doesn't matter what kind of steps they would like to take. Let us say, like starting the war in Afghanistan. You can't find any one document about it, because it was the decision to start a military adventure in Afghanistan was accepted in a very narrow circle of Politburo, in some summer house in Crimea, and never registered. And even Gorbachev couldn't find anything besides a small piece of paper where it was written about plan about A. When you keep things in such a secrecy, they don't leak out.
Now, I have to add an answer to your question. You might say there was a perfect storm here, because nobody, certainly not the Soviets, but not even the other parties to the conflict, had an interest in publicizing the measurements, the degree of the Soviet intervention. Just the Egyptians, for instance, once they did shift from the Soviet to the American camp in the mid-70s after the Yom Kippur War, certainly didn't want to credit the Soviets for having won or made any gains in the Yom Kippur War on their behalf. But as things were going on, the Israelis once, in order to recruit more U.S. support, tried to make a public statement about that, hey, there are Soviet anti-aircraft missiles being operated against us in Egypt. There are Soviet planes flying there against us in Egypt. And the Americans slapped them down so hard that the Israelis never tried that again. This was in April 1970. And from then on, Israeli officialdom only spoke about Egyptian aircraft, Egyptian missiles, and so forth, and the Soviet aspect was played down and sometimes even censored out. Just to give one example, only a couple of years ago, they released some of the testimonies before the Agranat Commission. That was a commission of inquiry that was set up to establish why Israel was taken by such surprise on Yom Kippur of 1973. And one of the main witnesses, then the deputy chief of staff, and the man who's considered the genius of the Israeli Armored Corps, stated very simply, "We knew that we were actually fighting the Russians." That's a quote. It's the epigraph of our foreword to the book. But this was, I would say, played down as much as possible by Israeli officialdom. And over time, although the details were more or less known either at the time or shortly afterward, the dots were not connected, and certainly not in historiography. So the U.S. didn't want to make too much of it because they were already, first the Johnson administration, then the Nixon administration, were already badly enough embroiled in Vietnam, and they didn't want to point up another Soviet advance elsewhere in the world. The Egyptians, as I said, of course did not. And the Israelis, although they would have liked to point out this, even when they shut down, when there was the famous dogfight of July the 30th, 1990, when the Israeli jets shot down four Soviet MiGs over Egypt for none on the Israeli side, it was a famous victory. Even then, Israel didn't publicize it at the time until the foreign press got wind of it and published it. And then the Israelis very gleefully confirmed it, but they didn't publish it in advance. So that there was, as I say, a perfect storm here for concealing the fact. And it was just the happenstance that these Soviet veterans in the disintegrating USSR had this pressing interest to show up their deeds in Egypt. We can discuss later why this came about, that actually gave us the key. And when we started checking it out against the reports that were already existing in the, say, in archival records and sometimes in the literature, we found that their reports were, I would say, not perfectly reliable, but on the whole, very reliable.
So that's one part of the story that resonated with me as a military historian and someone who's worked on veterans, was the kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, maybe peskiness of the existence of these people who actually fought the war that just can't be ignored, no matter what happens with the official record and the meetings of the Politburo. You know, there are these people out there that want recognition, both in terms of financial benefits as veterans, but also just the recognition as kind of in the legacy of the Spanish Civil War and so forth, the foreign fighters.
Exactly. Because the Soviet Union never confirmed that they had regular soldiers down there in Egypt, not only advisors to the Egyptian forces, which did an important job themselves, but entire integral Soviet units, formations, were fighting there in Egypt. The Soviets never confirmed that. When the soldiers were repatriated to the Soviet Union, they were quarantined. They were made to sign pledges of secrecy. Nothing was entered into their documents about their service in Egypt. And when the Soviet Union began to disintegrate, most of them were approaching or already were in pension age. The difference in benefits between a combat veteran and just a discharged soldier was already significant during the economic crisis that befell the Soviet Union when it began to fall apart. And on top of that, it was also a matter of their dignity, A, towards their families. I mean, the grandchildren ask, Dad, what did you do in the army? But also to stand up for the reputations of their fallen comrades who had never been recognized as heroes. And the Soviets lost at least a few dozen servicemen in the war with Israel, probably more. There's no full count anywhere. We've compiled more or less a list of, that's already approaching 100. Somewhere between 70, I'd say over 70, between 70 and 100.
There is a promise to in Moscow to put all the names on the park on one of the hills around the Moscow, and they put there all the names of fallen soldiers in the Cold War, including Egypt. And what is very strange that law that was passed still in Yeltsin's time, I think it was 94-95. Which recognized their battle service in the Middle East and in other parts of the world, doesn't recognize as an internationalist soldier people who were fighting in the Spanish War. So, for example, whoever survived till then couldn't get any recognition and benefits, and it was very important because you could buy food at certain places more than you could, that you can get in any other shop. You can get some gas for your car without queuing for it, and so on and so on and so on.
Now, we have to add that this literature really flourished around the mid-1990s and into the early 2000s, the first year or two of Putin's administration, there was still some of it appearing. I would say that it hasn't been completely stamped out now, but there are a lot. They must exercise a lot more caution, because just as there was a law passed in Yeltsin's day recognizing their service, there was a law passed in Putin's, under Putin's administration, criminalizing the falsification of history to the detriment of the Russian interest, which means that if you publish anything historical that the administration doesn't like, you can wind up in jail. So there are a lot of people who spoke with us quite freely in the 90s are no longer talking with anyone without getting permission, without the interviewer getting permission first, when they know that the permission is not going to be granted. And we've pointed out a possible trend in those among those that do publish now to switch from overtly documentary publications, their memoirs, research, articles, and so forth, to so-called fiction, but with very clear hints that it's based on their own experience, except that they can't be charged with falsifying history when they say, well, this is just an imaginary story. And we bring in the book a few very, very poignant examples of people up to a general who published his story about how his alter ego, engineering officer, was flown to Egypt on the very eve of the Six-Day War and actually helped of the Yom Kippur War, and actually directed the canal crossing by one of the Egyptian armies the next day. And there's no doubt the person is of sterling reputation. And his story stands up against any kind of criticism. We developed tools to check these the authenticity and the accuracy of these memoirs. We can't take everything for granted that whatever appears in print is necessarily true. But, for instance, some of them maintained journals, diaries at the time. Against standing orders. They weren't supposed to do that. They weren't supposed to take photographs, and some of them did and smuggled them back. And, of course, anything that was written down at the time is even more reliable than things that people just recall 30 or 40 years later. On top of that, there's also the question of what the people were likely to know at the time. And here, for instance, there's a distinction between just the regular servicemen, who are usually quite accurate in describing what they witnessed and what they did. But it's very interesting to see, to read what they write about what they knew about what was going on in the outside world. And we know that this is what was imparted to them by their political officers, and that's an interesting insight in itself, but it doesn't necessarily indicate the facts. On the other hand, a large part of this literature was contributed by the military interpreters, of whom there were hundreds in Egypt, probably a total of, close to 2,000 over the years. They were drawn from all over the academies in the Soviet Union. So there were people with the training to write, with some training in regional affairs. Of course, most of them were Arabic specialists, some of them Hebrew specialists, some of them English specialists. And they were attached to ranking officers. So although they may have been just lieutenants or captains, they went along with the generals to meetings with the Egyptian top brass, to sessions of the Egyptian military academy. They got to know a lot more than what you would expect from people of their rank. As I say, they were perceptive. They had the know-how. So, and many of them went on later to become leading academics or journalists on Middle Eastern affairs. So they know what they're writing about, and a lot of it checks out very accurately against what we know from Western and Israeli sources. So this part of the literature is particularly valuable.
So your discussion there, I think, should make clear to listeners how careful you were with sources, which is especially important in the context of a revisionist history. If you're really trying to retell this story that has been hidden, you have to pay careful attention to the sources. And you've just made completely clear how careful you were, and acknowledging that they're not perfect, but given the problems that you're trying to overcome, certainly legitimate.
And when there's so many of them, I mean, we're talking now. Since we accumulated this literature as it was appearing, much of it was in ephemeral forms like local newspapers, sometimes even the organs of various companies or institutions, local newspapers, as I said, sometimes on the internet, but it didn't always stay on the internet. So that the fact that we printed them out and filed them as it was coming out probably gives us a unique collection of this literature, certainly outside the former Soviet Union and probably even inside the former Soviet Union too.
Well, no, I won't agree to that. Yeah. I think that inside of the former Soviet Union, inside of Russia, they have a very good collection because they would follow everyone, and especially now when you can stop any publication according to your directives. But what is very exciting is that the people who live outside of Russian borders now in different countries, it's considered to be, they have published very freely even after the people in Russia itself stopped even talking to people. They have given some phone numbers in Moscow to some documentary director of television to meet. He wanted to make a movie about the Soviet presence in Egypt at the time, and they refused to meet him in Moscow. And in other parts of the former Soviet Union, people are free to talk and free to write. And especially when they have to set rules, to set the record straight because of some publication in Russia, and they cannot agree to it. And they are more, sometimes they're also scared. One of them, for example, said to the journalist who interviewed him that he is afraid to talk because he doesn't have a place to live in, and he is afraid that he won't get any apartment, even small, for him and his family if he will open his mouth.
To give you an example of what you asked about before, checking out the veracity of these publications, of course. Now, when some of these veterans have turned to fiction or so-called fiction, it makes it even more complicated. One of the latest examples was a former interpreter who is now a professor of English at a university in the Caucasus. He published a novel about entitled A Bullet Needs No Interpreter, about the adventures of an interpreter in the Soviet military. And he was attached to a squadron of Soviet reconnaissance aircraft that were based in Egypt and used to overfly the Sixth Fleet. And he writes there that, you know, under the coming from the mouth of his alter ego in this book, we used to fly so low over the USS Independence that we could make out the rivets on the deck. And once one of the planes flew too low and crashed into the sea. Now, there's a veterans literature of the U.S. Navy, too, of course. And we looked on the website and other publications of the veterans of the USS Independence. And, of course, USS Independence was in the Mediterranean at the time, and it was overflown by these Tu-16 Soviet aircraft. But there's no record that they ever crashed into the sea. On the other hand, there was such a record that happened with a U.S. aircraft carrier same year in the Norwegian Sea. So this particular author, being a professor, he's on the website of his university. There was an email address there, so we wrote to him. This is one of the few cases that we did this in recent years, because on the whole, we're very wary not to get people into trouble, especially in Russia itself. And he responded to our first email. He stopped afterwards. and said, yes, you're right. I'm referring to an incident that happened to an airplane of the same squadron, same model, same year in the Norwegian Sea. I just added it here to add color. So that, of course, is a pitfall that you have to guard against, especially when dealing with the fictionalized genre of these memoirs. But on the other hand, it does give you some insights that you have to follow up on, because at the time that this Russian aircraft did crash into the Norwegian Sea, there was some worry that it was carrying nuclear weapons. And if it was from the same squadron as the one in Egypt, that, of course, raises that question, and we had to investigate that, and so on and so forth. So we spend a lot of time, it's not for nothing that this book appeared almost 20 years after we started the project, a lot of time checking out every detail from every possible point of view, going for U.S. documents, Israeli documents, British documents.
German documents.
German documents. And in one particular instance, also even Egyptian documents, which are usually completely inaccessible. But the Israeli forces captured a lot of Egyptian documents after the Israeli countercrossing of the canal in the Yom Kippur War. And they're stored away in the Intelligence Heritage Center of the Israeli military. And we went there and just leafed through them. And there was a lot there concerning the joint activity with the Soviet advisors. So that was an important source for Egyptian documentation of the Soviet role, which no one practically had used before.
So, and that's another aspect of the book that I think makes it relevant, is that it's it speaks to not only the confrontation between the Soviet Union and Israel and Egypt in the Middle East in the military sense, but it as you've just made clear, it tells us about the history of the Soviet Union and Russia and the freedom of the press and nationalism and so forth, the evolution of that in the former Soviet Union. It talks about, obviously, the history of Israel, the history of Egypt, and then the history of the Cold War. So I think maybe we can turn now to, we addressed it a little bit when we talked about motives for suppressing the actual Soviet engagement, but there's another, I think, important intervention you make here, and that's about the mythology about the expulsion of the Soviet forces by Sadat prior to the Yom Kippur War. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Before that, I would like to point to tell you another story about our sources. In both instances, in both books, they have been asked to cut the sources because there are too many. And
asked by the editors, not by censorship.
By editors, because they take too much place, too much paper. And we were prepared to give up the publication, but not to cut one source. Because it both of the books are going against what has been accepted as a prevalent history, and if people want to check it, they have to have all our sources before them, and not let us say combine in one paragraph or all full page or something like that. They have they came to distinguish between source and source and check if they like it. So this is just to tell you how we value the sources themselves, what they can add to the researcher.
This delayed the publication of the book by about 3 years,
yeah.
Because we had to go from one publisher to another until one, which we're very grateful to, Hearst Publishers in London, was willing to accept the book at full length. And we appreciate that greatly, because we think it's enormously important, first of all, that this whole new genre of sources be presented to the English reader. It hasn't been done before. And this may also open some new avenues of research for other conflicts as well, because we know, for instance, that the Middle Eastern veterans took their cue from the Afghansi, from the much more numerous and younger people who returned from the Afghanistan war and also fought for their rights. And it may very well be possible for researchers now to do the same for the Afghanistan war, as we have, as we hope we have done, for the Soviet-Israeli war. So that was very important to us. Now, to get back to your question about the Cold War, the Cold War aspect and the myth of the Sadat's expulsion of the Soviet advisors from Egypt. That's one of a series of prevailing concepts in Western and Israeli historiography that we have had to challenge by checking these new sources and also revisiting the existing ones. Because in many cases, and we point to two real the real villains of the story in terms of falsifying the historical record are two. One is Muhammad Hassanein Haikal, the Egyptian propagandist, who established the story of how the massive Soviet intervention in 1969-70 began, and Henry Kissinger on the American side, who more or less established the myth of how it ended by Sadat supposedly expelling the Soviets in 1972.
Thanks to his intervention, of course.
Because both of them were very quick to publish their versions. In Haikal's case, it was a series of books. In Kissinger's case, it was his voluminous memoirs. They published them early, and they weren't the first in history, of course, to really establish their version of history by coming out with it first. But they certainly did a very good job of it, because if you follow the trail of footnotes from one book to another in the vast historiographic literature, you find that in a very, very high percentage, I'd say almost 100% of the cases, it all harks back somehow to Haikal or Kissinger for those two events that I just mentioned. Now, to take the this matter of Sadat's expelling the Soviets, supposedly expelling the Soviets, the whole concept so far was that because of the global process of the time and following the Soviets' bad experience in the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, they were propelled towards a responsible and cautious foreign policy, and they went along with Kissinger's, you know, trademark policy of the time, and therefore they were unwilling to support Egypt's offensive plans against Israel. They weren't willing to support to provide the necessary offensive weapons, particularly medium-range missiles and long-range attack bombers. And therefore, after the apotheosis of détente in the May 1972 summit in Moscow, there was a rift between Sadat and the Soviets, and Sadat abruptly expelled the Soviet advisors from Egypt. And the more we looked into it, the more we saw that this never happened. What happened was that the Soviet integral units, that is the anti-aircraft division and the auxiliary units that came with it, had accomplished their mission by the end of the war of attrition. They had imposed on Israel, they had forced Israel to accept a very unfavorable ceasefire, and all, because Israel was sustaining such losses of aircraft, and especially the crews of those aircraft, which were irreplaceable, even if the Americans were willing to replace the aircraft, which they not always were, that Israel was forced to accept the ceasefire on August 7th, 1970, and the Soviets and Egyptians immediately violated it by advancing the SAM batteries up to the canal bank, which created a no-fly zone for the Israelis on the other side, and this essentially created the precondition for the canal crossing on Yom Kippur. So once the Soviets had accomplished that mission, which was a very important accomplishment, and they are very proud of it, the veterans who accomplished it, they were no longer really necessary there. Egyptian personnel was completing training in the Soviet Union to operate the weapons that before that only the Soviets could operate. And the Soviets and Egyptians both had an interest in returning them home. But they couldn't do that openly because they had never confirmed they were there. So now under the guise of expelling Soviet advisors, it was the integral units that were repatriated, but the advisors actually stayed in Egypt and continued preparing the Egyptian military for the ultimate canal crossing in 1973. The work plans are there. These are among the captured documents. They're the work plans. They're the details, the personal lists of the advisors who continued operating with the Egyptian forces. Now, the really intriguing part here is that all this should have been questioned at the time, because a few days before the Yom Kippur War, one of the few signs that the Israelis did pick up that something was afoot was the Soviets evacuated the dependents of the Soviet advisors from Egypt. So what advisors in Egypt? They were expelled 15 months earlier, weren't they? And yet, there it is. Of course, it's a lot more complicated. I've oversimplified it now. But now we have both the documentation from the Soviet, from the advisors themselves, who say, yes, we were recalled to Cairo, and we spent a few weeks just idling in Cairo, which created some drinking problems, and then we were sent back to the Egyptian units and continued our work. And the Egyptian documents show exactly the same, that there was a mass recall of all the Soviet advisors from the field units to Cairo, which was never done usually. Usually they were rotated singly to create a continuity, right? So, but this time, say, all the five advisors plus interpreter who were attached to an Egyptian brigade are all recalled to Cairo at the same time, 2 days before Sadat makes his dramatic announcement. And this creates an influx of hundreds, if not thousands, of Soviet advisors into Cairo, which is bound to be noticed by military attaches and other foreign agents, and reported back home. And this cemented the idea that the Soviets were being expelled, but they just filtered back to their units a few weeks later, and they remained. And there was no rift, and the weapons that Sadat supposedly was denied showed up in Egypt within a few months, both the Scud missiles and the Su-20 and Su-17 attack bombers, which supposedly were denied to him. And this was known, if not exactly at the time, then very shortly later. And yet the concept remained. Trying to figure out how it was established so effectively is really just as intriguing as following the developments themselves. And these are two strands that run parallel in the book.
So I think the Russian side of the story and their motivations and the motivations for their actions is becoming clearer thanks to your discussion. How, and if you can't answer this, I don't recall this directly coming out of the book, but how has the evolution of Israeli political culture influenced the telling of this story, and how might that change knowing what we now know thanks to your book?
Well, I would say one thing, that Israelis always look for truth, some kind of truth, because of so many fallen soldiers and so many families who became families of the fallen soldiers. And people wanted to know how their dear got killed. And there are still some cases of missing in action, and people are looking, still looking for possibility to find how, when, where, and so on.
Why?
So what I can say about my knowledge of Israeli sources is that there was a trend to write truthfully whatever was known at the time. And sometimes there was a need to make it fit the international, exposure of the same currencies.
Although, you know, although the Israeli military managed to reverse the course of the Yom Kippur War about a week in, by first, halting the Egyptian advance and then making a counter-crossing of the canal, there was a lot of heroism in there, some of it by people I knew, and I lost a lot of friends in that war. But the initial surprise of the Yom Kippur War is a lasting national trauma in Israel. We've never quite overcome it. And the idea that we have to really investigate it, understand it, in order to prevent this ever happening again, is something that's very pervasive in Israeli political culture. Now, I have to say that although our findings, both in the previous book and the present one, have aroused a lot of opposition in the Israeli academic circles, we still have a lot of debate going on here in a very collegial way, but still a debate. There's not been, with one exception, which I'll get to perhaps in a moment, with one exception, there's never been any official attempt to suppress or to silence us.
No, I would say that even the military that we know and whom we met during these years, they are very supportive of our findings, because they also have some more stories and they come to us with their stories. What I would like to stress, I think that we didn't mention it, but working on both of the books, we, let us say, that we discovered the plan of action by the Soviet military and political establishment. And if you read with some attention, you can see this plan and how it is employed in other cases. For example, in 2008, we were asked to write
analysis
of Russian of war against Georgia. And we mentioned that it fits the plan that we discovered in our first book, which was published a year before. And we would say that the next on the trigger would be Crimea and the Ukraine. And you see, some people may say that we are clairvoyant. Some people will say that we are
conspiracy theorists.
Conspiracy theory, or some will say that, you know, you read your material very carefully. So it's, I think that both of the books can be very interesting for a layman who is interested in military, but also for specialists that can think about similar situations in future. I like to say that in one of the books, other books, there is a sentence like, the good plan always wins. So it's like the same kind, relation is in Russia to their plans. The same plan always wins. And you can see it now in Syria.
Yes, there is a definite analogy here. It's not a perfect analogy. Historical analogies are never perfect. But nonetheless, Latakia and Tartus in Syria are now, for the Russians, pretty much what for the Soviets Alexandria and Port Said in Egypt were 50 years ago. They need these bases in the warm waters of the Mediterranean, and they're willing to invest a great political, military, and economic effort into maintaining them. It's sometimes, and the Syrian story has obscured from wider attention in the West, the fact that the Russians have even reestablished a base in Egypt now. There's a small but growing Russian presence now at Sidi Barani, which is near the Libyan border, from which they're using now to project some influence into Libya itself, also in the ongoing civil war there. There have been joint exercises by the Soviet and Egyptian military at a place with a lot of historical connotations, El Alamein. The present day implications are there. To the political issue that you mentioned a moment ago, I would like to add this, that although we don't have any political agenda in our research, we're not making any prescriptive projections into the present-day Israeli policy. I'm a left-winger in Israeli politics. Isabella is more of a centrist. But our findings have been more welcomed in the Israeli right-wing than in my own left. One reason for that is that we have not found much evidence in the material that we went over. Of course, absence of evidence is not absolute proof of evidence that, you know, that it, things didn't happen, but it's indicative. We have not found much basis for the very fashionable trend in recent years to blame Israel for rejecting so-called Egyptian peace feelers in the years leading up to the Yom Kippur War. What we found is that the Soviets and the Egyptians, each one for their own motives, were locked in to an aspiration for a military achievement before any political settlement from the summer of 67, from a few weeks after...
Even before
the war was even in progress in June 67, and certainly very shortly afterwards. One of the interesting discoveries we've made is the name of the Soviet architect of the canal crossing plan, Lieutenant General Pyotr Lashchenko, who was not mentioned once. We can say this thanks to Google. Not mentioned once in the Western literature on the period, nor even in those intelligence reports that have so far come to light, who was in Egypt in the summer of 67 to organize, first of all, the Egyptians for defense, because they were sure that the Israelis would press on across the Suez Canal and storm Cairo, but also to plan the ultimate recrossing of the canal eastward by the Egyptians. And he had drawn up a plan and presented it with the attached list of weaponry that would be necessary and the training program that would be necessary to prepare the Egyptians for it by the end of 67 or early 1968 at the very latest. And they followed this plan methodically and systematically until they felt that the conditions were ripe. I've already discussed the fact, you know, the contribution to creating the no-fly zone over the canal that made it possible, but also the level of training of the Egyptian army, the induction of the necessary weaponry, the political conditions. And what usually is the approach in historiography up to now was that the Soviets kept pressing the Egyptians not to go to war at all. What we found is they pressed them frequently not to go to war yet until you're completely ready. So the Israelis government has to be held responsible, perhaps, for, you know, be trying every possibility to prevent the war. But the so-called Egyptian peace feelers that were sent out, particularly in the 2 years preceding the war, as we found, were mostly smokescreen for the military preparations that were in progress in full collaboration with the Soviet Union at the same time. And there's even a funny incident in the book where Sadat's emissary, Hafez Ismail, makes his first visit to Washington in early 1973, and presents the Egyptian peace plan to Kissinger. General Ahmed Ismail, the Egyptian minister of war, is in Moscow going over the war plans and the list of weaponry and so on with the Soviets. And when Brezhnev and Kissinger meet to prepare the San Clemente summit in the summer of 73, and Kissinger tells him what the Hafez Ismail has told him in Washington, and Brezhnev says, well, we have our Ismail too. And both of us will someday become two Ismails. And this goes over, there's no indication that Kissinger even picked up on this hint, you know, that, you know, don't put too much credence in these Egyptian peace feelers.
Well, fascinating. I think this is a great place to start. I mean, we don't want to give everything away. We want people to read the book. So I want to thank you both for your time. And I do this with my interviewees. I should have warned you, I suppose, to allow you to prepare. So if you want to punt on this one, you can. But I always ask, what book have you read recently that our listeners could also be interested in besides yours?
Oh, it's a very difficult question, absolutely difficult question, because we have been immersed in Russian history veterans literature. And of here, I would like, first of all, to say that this literature is very interesting. And if anyone want to make an acquaintance with it, it will have to be translated. But you could feel the heroism, day-to-day heroism of these people who were sent to unknown places, sometimes didn't know where they were sent. But how they treat each other, how they accept Egyptians and interrelation between two absolutely different people on the social, on the cultural, and even religious point. And so on. This is very interesting scene. And another, I don't remember when I read fiction lately, because the head is occupied with...
Isabella has a nice Russian joke about a writer from Chukotka, you know, the province of Russia that's opposite the Bering Strait from Alaska, who fancies himself as a novelist, and he sends his manuscript to publisher after publisher in Moscow and gets rejected, and finally one of them asks him in. So he goes to Moscow, and the editorial board has him in for a session, and they ask him, have you read War and Peace? No. Have you read Crime and Punishment? No. Have you read Dead Souls? And the guy explodes and say, look, I'm not the Chukchi who reads, I'm the Chukchi who writes.
well put.
Reading the veterans' memoirs has gotten me more interested than I ever was in reading memoirs in general. And the three last books that I have read are memoirs by people who have nothing to do with this case, but are just beautifully written memoirs, which I would recommend to anyone. One is Russell Baker's, the former New York Times columnist, has a beautiful memoir of his childhood. Another by S.J. Perlman, the American Jewish humorist, who has a wonderful memoir of his childhood in Worcester, Massachusetts. And the third is now out of fashion because there's some nasty words there about an Indian tribe. But still, it's a very good book, Betty McDonald's The Egg and I. I suddenly have a complete new insight on the value of memoirs. And although these have nothing to do with our case, they may have something to do with our next project, but we'll leave that for our next talk.
I wanted to say that it reminds me that we read the memoirs. One of the, I think, more very interesting memoirs were by Nabokov.
Mm-hmm.
And really, and you can enjoy the writing, you can enjoy the style, and also the matter. And I think it's, and sometimes some humorous books, which are very easy to forget, but you enjoy them when you're reading them.
Thank you both for your time and your suggestions, and best of luck with future projects. You've been listening to my interview with Isabella Ganor and Gideon Remez about their new book, The Soviet-Israeli War, 1967 to 1973, the USSR's Military Intervention in the Egyptian-Israeli Conflict. It should be appearing in the next week or so in the United States with Oxford University Press. I believe it's already out in Great Britain. If you're in Europe, you should be able to get your copy. This is Jay Lockenauer from Temple University. Thanks for listening to New Books in Military History. Hope you'll come back.